Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. When it comes to attention deficit disorder, the question has long been, is it being overdiagnosed? The numbers of kids who are said to have the disorder keeps going up, but how do you know if a child needs treatment or if he or she is just another restless kid? We'll kick that around today, and we'll talk about how to get the right treatment for your son or daughter. With us again is Dr. Wes Crenshaw. He's a board-certified family psychologist who writes the weekly Double Take Advice column for teens and parents in the Lawrence Journal World. He's also author of the new book, I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not, Successful Living with ADD and ADHD. And Wes, always good to have you. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
He's joined today by Sarah, who will be entering her senior year in college this fall. Sarah, nice to have you.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
And Jordan is a 24-year-old from the Kansas City Metro. Both have been diagnosed and treated for ADHD. They have a lot to say about what works and what doesn't. And Jordan, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Well, Wes, let's begin by just getting some terms straightened out here. Explain the difference between ADD and ADHD.
Oh, my goodness.
Here we go. Yeah.
This just causes more trouble. This is the worst branding of any diagnosis ever. They need to try and go back and start over again. So just to give you the quick history, because it's actually important to understand. So back in, I think it was the DSM-3, it was called Attention Deficit Disorder, and it had with hyperactivity and with inattentive. And for whatever reason, in the DSM-3R...
What are you talking about?
Oh, dear. I forgot. Okay. Yeah. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which goes way back to the 50s. And there was a 1, a 2, a 3, and a 3R, and a 4. And soon, there's a 5 now, and it goes into effect in October.
Aha.
And both 3R, 4, and 5, all three of them, call this disorder Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. Well, this presents numerous problems for the layperson because most people with attention deficit disorder, like the two young women in our studio today, are not hyperactive. Mm. So when you say they have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, then you go on and add the following possible labels. With hyperactivity, which is ridiculous, that's like a cheese quesadilla. It's redundant if you have ADHD with hyperactivity. Then you can also say they have ADHD that's inattentive type, which really is going back now and discounting the hyperactivity.
But you're saying they're both ADD, not ADHD.
Now, see, there you go. This is why it's bad branding, because no matter how I explain it, it still comes out wrong. They are ADHD by Diagnostic Manual 4 and 5. Mm-hmm. Which makes no sense. So you'll get people will come
You're
in.
You're losing me here.
I know. I just knew this would happen. Okay.
Yeah.
So people come in and you say, "Wow, I wonder if you have ADHD." And immediately they say, "Oh, my child isn't hyperactive," or "I'm not hyperactive," which is irrelevant because the vast majority of people aren't hyperactive who have ADHD. And the real issue is inattention. And that's the big point we have to focus on.
So ADHD can refer to the magic word you just blurted out, inattention.
That's exactly right. And so this is you have done a great job of showing why this is a bad branding, confusing diagnosis.
Bottom line,
if you have ADHD, it does not mean you have hyperactivity.
Okay. In last week's column, you wrote this, Wes, it's become trendy to bash the diagnosis of ADHD and those of us who hand it out, as well as, by extension, those who have it. Why has ADHD become such a controversial diagnosis? And, you know, I mean, should it be?
You know, it is so interesting. People are just all over this. There are these books that it doesn't exist and we're all drugging the kids up. It's way more interesting, I think, to study you know, who shot Kennedy and whether Nazis reverse engineered their technology from aliens. This is the way it sounds sometimes. And I am not sponsored by, nor do I have any investments in any drug company. And I am skeptical of big pharmaceutical companies, but I can guarantee you there's not a conspiracy to diagnose all the little kids. And we become too interested in this controversy when there isn't really any controversy about ADHD.
So why do people think there's a controversy?
Because talking heads get on the TV and write books and title them exciting things like ADHD does not exist. I'm almost afraid to mention that because then you'll go buy the book.
Mm-hmm.
And the individual who wrote that book is basically saying simply that there are many other diagnoses that show the same symptoms as ADHD.
Yeah.
Great. Not a problem. That's part of the diagnostic process.
Mm-hmm.
But to go around telling people it doesn't exist goes beyond being inaccurate. It shames people who have the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
It tells them they just ought to get up and do something because they're lazy and stupid and irresponsible. And that's not helpful.
Well, Sarah, let's talk about this a little bit because ADHD and ADD still seem to get a lot of flack from society. As Wes just said, people joke when they have trouble focusing that they must have ADD or ADHD. What would you say to those who don't really understand just how serious a disorder like this can be?
Well, I think usually when I'm in college, and a lot of my friends especially, they're joking about how they can't focus on their studying for finals, especially
yeah.
right now. So they try to say that they must have ADD, and I just sit there and I kind of tell them where my focus issues come from, and it kind of like shows them more that they are more on like the lazy side of things, even though I do have friends who also have ADD and like they understand it a little bit more. But for me, it's more there's certain like times where I can't study during the day because I'm in a different mindset, or there's like certain areas like I can't go to the library to study because I people watch. I just cannot stop looking at the people who walk past me, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much like I get on my laptop and I just want to go on Facebook and that's why I can't study on studying.
Yeah.
Like focus on studying or anything like that. It's more just the things around me are distracting me. And I think when I explain that to people, it makes them understand more because what's distracting them is the fact that they want to go on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram rather than they're just distracted by the little noises around them and stuff like that.
Do you get tired of people sort of making jokes about this? Is there an insensitivity about it that
no,
rubs you the wrong way?
I wouldn't say that there's like an insensitivity to it because right now, like in college, a lot of people, I think there's even some college students who would wish that they had ADD because they would want like the drugs to help them study and things like that. But it's like I don't really get offended by it at all. But when I was first diagnosed, I didn't really realize that there was like a stigma behind it because it's just never anything I would have thought of.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized that some people were like, oh, you have ADD. And it didn't really bother me because I was like, yeah, I may have ADD, but at least I'm getting help now and I feel better about myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because before being diagnosed, I kind of just thought that I was stupid. And I had to work so much harder at everything. I didn't get why I couldn't understand any of it. And my brain just felt so clouded. And then after being diagnosed and getting on medicine and finding something that worked for me, I was like, hey, you know what? I'm actually really smart. Like, I feel good about myself. I don't really care what anyone else thinks.
And when did you get diagnosed?
I was diagnosed the second semester of my freshman year. So I went through my first semester of college without being diagnosed. And that's when I kind of realized that I needed help because I was struggling so much.
Hmm. Jordan, how about you? When did you get diagnosed and why did you go that route?
Well, it was definitely assumed that I had ADD for a while just because I was kind of a crazy, super talkative kid. But it was around the middle of junior high, I think, where ADD was more so considered and medication involved because, you know, school gets harder as you get older.
Mm-hmm.
You start to pay less attention. Tests are harder to study for, even if you're smarter. That ADD really starts to take effect and you really do start to need that medication. But with that being said, I wasn't really given the right medication and the proper diagnosis and treatment until a few years ago, I would say, just because, I mean, it is very misunderstood. And it's an easy thing to misunderstand and mistreat.
Well, what's misunderstood about it? What do you say to people who don't get it?
It's something that, like with anything, some people are going to get and some people aren't. And I'm not going to hammer it into anyone who's just not going to understand. I'll definitely explain it to people who are interested in it. And a lot of people are, and they get it. I will say I'm not really offended so much by people's comments on it just because they just don't understand. But more so at times when people kind of downplay what you're feeling, mm-hmm. if you're trying to explain it to them, you know, saying, oh, why don't you just get up earlier or why don't you just mm-hmm. study earlier? That's when mm-hmm. it gets more so offensive because I feel like there's, you know, this brick wall in front of me and I can't get through it. And it's not like by choice. You know, I don't choose to be to deal with stress.
I was just going to ask you, so what is it like for you? What a great analogy. It's like a brick wall right in front of you, and you can't break through it to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely very frustrating. It's not so much, you know, on occasion I feel like I can't study, or on occasion I'm tired. It's a constant thing that just follows you around all day to a point where, you know, you can't focus. You really have to pay attention to the things that are being said to you more so than the normal individual would.
Yeah.
You have to be cognizant of your time management because I can find myself doing all sorts of things and, you know, there goes a few hours.
Wow.
But it's a definite constant thing that's, you know, it plagues you, I guess, more so. It's not just, oh, I'm just feeling, you know, kind of tired.
Oh, you explained that so well. I really appreciate that, Jordan.
Yeah.
That's just terrific. I mean, Wes, no question, the numbers seem to suggest there's an issue out there. According to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, 11% of kids ages 4 to 17 are now diagnosed with ADD. That's up from 8% about a decade ago. You know, and the question becomes then, is it overdiagnosed? What do you make? What do you make of all this?
Yeah, we get this a lot.
All the time, right?
The answer is it is not overdiagnosed. Let me pitch it to you a different way, and I'll explain exactly what I mean. So we find clinically, and particularly Sarah is an example of getting all the way through high school without being diagnosed. There's a whole lot of people who probably would benefit from treatment and diagnosis who are not getting it. And so I could easily say it's terribly underdiagnosed, except that would be equally silly because in order to know if anything is over or underdiagnosed, you have to magically know how many people in the population really have the disorder. And we don't know that. So when people use that term, what really is a problem is not under or over diagnosis, it's misdiagnosis.
Ah.
It's poorly done diagnosis. And there's a whole lot of that going on.
I was going to say, how hard is it to diagnose something like this? Is it hard or is it not?
Well, it is harder than a lot of providers make it, and not nearly as hard as some people suggest it would be.
Mm-hmm.
So the big mistake, and I want to be clear with all our loyal listeners that are physicians, I love you guys. Without you, we'd be in big trouble, for sure.
But having said that,
the insurance company, let's blame them because I'm sure they're not listening. The insurance companies don't pay physicians to sit down and spend an hour with you or an hour and a half several times in order to diagnose you. They're not going to get paid for that. So if you just go to your physician and you say, I got online and I did this little quiz, and the quiz that happened to be sponsored by, I don't know, the Shire drug company, says, I have ADD. And the physician says, okay, and writes a script and hands it to you. That's not the way it should be done. And I'm actually not kidding. It's more true with adults, less true with pediatricians. In a pediatrician's office, they'll usually give you, your child or you as the parent, a thing called the Vanderbilt, which is really just a checklist of the symptoms. And you check them off, and at a certain cut level, based on the DSM-5, they give you the diagnosis. Even that's problematic.
And so it should be done how? And Jordan's nodding her head. I want to get her into this too. So,
Here is the procedure that is the standard of practice that really, if you're going to get your kid on treatment for this, you ought to expect. There are two good tests, the Barkley and the Connors. I happen to use the Connors. It's just the one I like. And they're both standardized tests that are norm referenced. What does that mean? It means they went out and gave it to a whole bunch of people. And these instruments can discriminate statistically between people who don't have ADD and people who do.
Mm-hmm.
And if you score above 65th percentile, then you are at risk for attention deficit if everything else in your history matches that.
Mm-hmm.
The higher you score, the further you deviate from the center based on the standardization sample of people your age and gender, the more likely it is you have ADHD. And if that fits with your history, that's how you make the diagnosis.
That's interesting.
And that testing is not very expensive compared to, you know, a full neurological battery or something, which is really usually overkill.
Jordan, again, you were nodding your head a couple of minutes ago, which is a big mistake you'll never repeat again because you know I'll ask you a question if I see you nodding your head.
Whoops.
But I gather you were sort of acknowledging the idea that maybe some of your friends have been given meds pretty quickly without really going through some of the tests that Dr. West just laid out here. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, that and also I personally went through a struggle for many years finding A, the right diagnosis, and B, the right medication. And so I understand that struggle with trying to talk to doctors and talk to them long enough to have them understand, you know, what you're dealing with personally, because we're all different,
mm-hmm.
and also understanding what drugs do and don't work for you. Because
you tried some drugs and they didn't work?
Yeah, I mean, I
all
was
drugs
on...
drugs that sort of do the same thing, but...
You would assume, like, a stimulant's a stimulant, right? Well, I was on a drug for a while, which definitely works really well for some people, and it's called Concerta. And I was on it off and on for several years.
And just let me insert one thing so that listeners know. There's really only two useful formulations for ADD. And for lack of better terms, we're going to call them the Ritalin-type medicines and the Adderall-type medicines. Mm. And they are both stimulants, but they're a little bit different. And the one that Jordan just mentioned is a Ritalin-type. It's based on a chemical formulation called methylphenidate. Mm. So with that explanation, have at it.
Yeah.
And actually, I was prescribed a few different Ritalin-type medications, but this is the one I was longest on. But towards the end of, you know, me taking it, I realized it was actually making me drowsy. It was actually causing me to sleep a lot.
Just the opposite of what it should be doing.
Exactly. And it sounds crazy, but once I changed, you know, my stimulants and started up the Adderall, that's when I really started to see a huge difference. And I had been given Adderall at the very beginning back, you know, when I was in junior high. But the problem was the physician gave me such a large dosage at the time because she was like, well, this girl's got some issues, that it almost seemed like it wasn't working because I just felt so hyped up at the time. Mm. So then I went down this other route that just wasn't the right one. And it's just really being cognizant of what's going on. And also, you know, on our end, we really need to communicate, you know, with the doctors and let them know what is and isn't working. Like, it's embarrassing sometimes to tell your doctor, well, I'm sleeping all day, because you're taking a stimulant. You're supposed to be focusing. You're just going to sound lazy.
Yeah, right,
so.
Right.
And it's worth noting, because Sarah had, we were talking about this in the show prep out in the green room. Sarah had the exact same problem with a Ritalin-type medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not unusual, because everybody else would be awake on a stimulant. And for people with ADD, sometimes it levels you out too much.
Yeah.
And you have to switch to the other type.
Right. And the medicine, it worked well for me the first 2 weeks, as it was my first time taking any kind of stimulant.
Yeah.
That's the first kind of medicine I started on, was Ritalin-based. And first 2 weeks, I felt great. Like, it worked so well. And I was so excited because I felt smart, because I was functioning right. And then 2 weeks after, I started sleeping constantly. It got to the point where I was awake for maybe 2 hours of the day.
Oh my gosh.
That's how sleepy it would make me. And so my prescriber ended up trying to give me another Ritalin-based booster to take halfway through the day to wake me up. Just ended up making me sleep more after taking the booster.
Oh my gosh.
So I was on that, and then she switched me to a different Ritalin-based medicine, which also made me sleep. So there was probably about a month, maybe month and a half, that I was just sleeping constantly, trying to figure out different Ritalin-based medicines, until I was finally switched to an Adderall-based medicine, and it completely changed, and I was no longer sleeping.
And Dr. West, the basic distinction between Adderall and Ritalin is what?
Well, I will explain that. Let me be clear that in my doctor world, it's a PhD, and so I'm not a medical doctor, but I do work closely with a lot of physicians, and we discuss these kinds of things extensively. And I actually, in the book, have what I call an experimental protocol in Chapter 13 that will help avoid some of the problems the young women are talking about today by going through and using a scientific method with your prescriber that, if he or she is on board, will help a lot. The difference is that one – get ready for science. One of them, Ritalin medicines, methylphenidate, are dopamine reuptake inhibitors, and they have also some other effect on norepinephrine. But that's the primary thing. Dopamine in the frontal lobe is what causes the ability to focus and execute your – ability to choose.
And that's the
The Ritalin product.
That's the Ritalin. Okay. And then Adderall?
Adderall is both a dopamine reuptake inhibitor, and it also creates more dopamine in the synaptic gap like caffeine does. Caffeine and cocaine and a lot of stimulants cause a rush of dopamine into the synaptic gap. And what Adderall and those types, Vyvanse, those type of medicines do is give a controlled version of that.
Okay.
So you get a little more effect for many people. But about 37% of people do better on one and 37% do better on the other.
I'm going to get our listeners involved here. We've already got some calls in the queue. 816-235-2888. Your questions about ADD, attention deficit disorder, or ADHD. We've done shows on this in the past. So many misconceptions, misunderstandings about what all this is. Maybe you're a parent out there dealing with some questions with your own son or daughter and want to call. Please do. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. And maybe the most basic question of all here, Wes, just to really make sure we're covering all our bases, but why a stimulant? Why are we stimulating kids to help them focus more? What's the cause and effect there?
Yeah, that's always a good one. It used to be said that it had a strange paradoxical effect on people, which is really not true. When these medicines focus on the part of the brain that is at the front of the brain so that it is what causes you to be able to choose what you're going to focus on and to inhibit behavior, like looking around at different things or doing impulsive things.
It does all that.
All that. And so by stimulating that specific part of the brain, we are able to improve people's attention and focus. The analog for this that most people know about if they go to Starbucks is caffeine. Caffeine does somewhat the same thing, hits the same receptor sites. And so you drink the caffeine and you think of these great ideas and you read a book at Starbucks and you use your laptop. Well, these young people have a lack of dopamine in the frontal lobe. And so when they take these stimulants, they are now able to inhibit hyperactive behavior or restless behavior or checking out the people in the library.
And Sarah and Jordan, no question that when you began to take it, it changed. It changed you for the better once you got it figured out.
Oh, it definitely did. And
difference.
And you can say, like going off what Wes said, like you could take caffeine. Like people might think, oh, if you have ADD, why don't you just take caffeine? Because that'll stimulate the brain. Caffeine does not work. Like I could drink 3 cups of coffee a day and still go take a nap. So it does not work for me, and that's why we need different stimulants that actually stimulate what we need in our brain. And it made a huge difference. It kind of, when I started medicine, it actually made us feel like there was a cloud in my brain that just disappeared. So it was like putting the sun back in my brain, basically.
Great analogy.
It made everything a lot brighter, and it made me be able to focus because it felt like this cloud was just weighing on everything and making me tired and not being able to find in my head what I needed to find.
And you too, Jordan?
Yeah, and I don't think I'm the only one in this regard, but I actually self-medicated a lot with caffeine. Like I could drink up to 8 cans of Diet Coke a day. I actually completely went cold turkey on diet soda because I was so addicted to it.
Mm. The Diet Coke company is so sorry to hear you say that.
Sorry, Coke. I still like you.
Yeah.
Well, the soft drink, that is, of course. No. But oftentimes people, you know, I've noticed who have focus issues drink a lot of caffeine, and it just doesn't have that same effect. Like she said, I could have an espresso shot and fall right asleep, you know. So that's oftentimes a really telling sign.
But no question that kids who are in high school facing finals as they are right now, or kids in college facing finals, the idea of getting hold of some of this stuff is pretty appealing because they think, well, just a couple days worth will get me through the studying I have to do for whatever test I'm facing here.
Yeah. And I mean, it's sad that it's used that way.
But is there kind of a back market in high school and college for, for all this stuff?
It's incredible how many friends I have that don't have ADD get a hold of medication to take during finals or even just when they have a hard test through the semester.
Does it help? Does it work for them?
It works for them, but not in the same way. Like, to put it this way, when I was taking finals last semester, I didn't really realize, like, it took until being diagnosed with ADD to find out just how many people without ADD take medicine for it.
Yeah.
And once I did, I was just so much more aware of it. And during finals week especially, my medicine, because you can kind of get a tolerance to medicine after a certain amount of time of using it, and my medicine was starting to wear off for me going into finals week, so it wasn't working as well as it normally does, which meant that my head was starting to feel more clouded again, basically. And my friends were taking it, but for them, it was like drinking 3 cups of coffee, and they would be really hyped up and really focused. So for me, taking medicine puts me on the same level as everyone else on a day-to-day basis, mm-hmm. them without medicine. But during finals week, they were taking it, which put them a level above me. And then my medicine was wearing off, which put me a level below them on a normal day. So I was basically 2 levels behind everyone else on focus. And so I felt like I was struggling and everyone else was like way above their normal performance rate. Yeah, and it was really quite unfair.
And I'm scared to death that we let out for just a moment anything about Adderall abuse. We're going to have every phone call in the studio lit. We probably will do a show about this. The young women have convinced me this morning that this is such a critical issue that it bears its own show sometime.
Yeah, I'm going to get to some phone calls here before a break. Judy from Independence emails us this at uptodate@kcur.org. When I saw Ritalin's effect on my son, it was like he was an entirely different child. He could sit still. He didn't touch every child as he passed their desk. He could study and remember. Once he passed through adolescence, he no longer needed the medication. Typical?
It isn't actually typical. It does happen sometimes. There's two issues there. Is it typical that a correctly diagnosed person on medicine does way better? Absolutely. It's less typical that they'll outgrow it in high school. And
meaning they'll need it the rest of their lives?
That is the latest thinking. And the reason we used to believe people outgrew it usually in late adolescence or out of college is because people are no longer in a learning environment. And so the intensity of what they are having to do diminishes. They learn their job. They're fine. Mm-hmm. They don't need medicine as much. But the underlying neurological condition does not usually remit if it's correctly diagnosed.
We're talking about ADD, ADHD this morning. Hope from Topeka. Hope, thanks for holding on. Good morning.
Oh, it's not a problem. I'm actually of the same age range as the ladies on the air. I wasn't diagnosed until I was 23, only 3 years ago. And I was mid-college struggling and felt literally like I was lazy and stupid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was like a light bulb that went off once they told me, this is what's wrong with you.
Mm-hmm. And what caused you to finally go to a doctor and get some help on it?
Two of my professors out at Washburn, I was in an international studies class for international politics, and I got an 11% on a paper. And, you know, my boyfriend read the paper, and I talked to some professors, and they said, you know, have you ever been checked out for something?
Wow.
And, you know, I went and 4 months later after testing and they went, yeah, you've got adult combined type ADHD.
And see, she
disorder of written expression.
And Hope, you uttered the words went and got testing. And that's right on the money. One of the reasons in the book in chapter 12, I have little principles in each chapter that I talk about. And the principle in 12 is with ADHD, you go from where you start. And if the diagnosis is correct, the treatment will work, just as it has for you and the young women in the studio today.
That new book from Dr. West is I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not Successful Living with ADD and ADHD.
Run out and buy it, Hope.
Thank you.
I don't know if the ladies have heard of this, the book, You Mean I'm Not Lazy, Crazy, or Stupid?
That's a great book. The author recently passed away, and that was the only problem with that book is that it is getting a little old now, but the ideas that it puts forth are excellent for really helping people to...
The title was just like a light bulb. It's like, what?
Yeah. That's like with Wes's book. I was like, oh, well, that completely makes sense.
Yeah. Hope, I'm glad you called. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. One more call before a break here. Let's go to David from Independence. David, we just lost you. I'm sorry. David, call back 816-235-2888. Let's go to a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here about ADD and ADHD. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with Dr. Wes Crenshaw about the whole question of the overdiagnosis of attention deficit disorder. Is it being overdiagnosed or not? We're also talking about ADHD. We're joined today by Sarah and Jordan, a couple of students who have dealt with this in their own lives. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Let's go back to some calls here quickly. Kim from Grandview. Kim, you're on the show. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. One of our kids was diagnosed with ADHD in fifth grade. We started in preschool. We noticed he was a tad hyper and climbing the walls and took him off sugar, and that did help with the hyperactivity, and we thought we were good. Kindergarten, they said, put him on drugs. He's ADHD, so we got him tested, and they said, no, potentially gifted, most likely bored, no medicine. And we went back and had him tested again in fifth grade because he was still having the problem seemed to be getting worse and worse, and he was diagnosed that time with the ADHD with hyperactivity. The first time he was on a medication that worked for him, it was just amazing because our morning routine was, okay, here's your three instructions. Feed the dog, put on your shoes, brush your teeth. I'll come back 5 minutes later. Which one did you do? Okay, now do another one. This first morning, I came back and he had done all three of them with no prompting, no nothing. It was just amazing. We did notice he was on Adderall, and they switched him to 12-hour Adderall, and he became mean and hateful and paranoid, and everyone was out to get him, and everyone hated him. The doctor kept telling me, oh, no, that's not it. It's something else because the medicine, you know, Adderall works, so 12 hours is not going to make a difference. And we finally ended up, we just took him off of it completely and switched doctors, and he went back to his normal self again. I mean, is that something that's common he was a complete personality change.
Yeah, that is such a good point. All right, so everybody remembers I'm not a medical doctor, but let me explain that a little bit. For younger kids, and I have two kids of my own who have ADD and are very successfully treated. For younger kids, many times, many, many, many times, the Adderall products tend to create more side effects. And the one I refer to is being too serious. And they just are, I don't know how to describe it any better, too serious. And the situation you're talking about with your child is actually worse than that. They were really mood disordered at that point. So clearly that is the wrong set of medicines for your kid, and you do want to change. You changed doctors, talked to them, did something different. Typically, the first thing a physician will do in that situation is switch them to the opposite type of medicine, particularly at that age. The other problem we run into here is that there's what I call micro-dosing. And I don't mean you take a teeny-weeny little bit. I mean you make more tiny changes in the dosage, and there's ways to do that that go beyond what we can talk about. But many times kids over-respond to a given level of a stimulant in a way that is really like you're describing. And as therapists, we get them in our offices with behavior problems that may well be related to side effects that can be controlled with a closer medication management. And that's just it. You see this all the time, and this is why it's crucial, and I think both women will agree with me, it's crucial to have a team relationship between parent, child, or young adult and therapist and the prescriber. And this happens far less often than it should.
All right. Kim, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. You know, this whole notion, it's going to come up in our conversation at some point, was this idea of, okay, if kids start this medicine at a very young age and they're taking it for many, many years, do they build up a tolerance to this this medication that eventually sort of begins to wear off?
Well, that is a great question. The answer is you better believe it. And what is strange to me is I studied the literature for this book. The chapter 13 is about how to talk with your prescriber about medicine. And I'm developing another book that it's going to be called ADD and Zombies. And it's in consultation with an APRN and a psychiatrist. And we're going to talk about how to avoid becoming a zombie on the medicine. And the problem we run into is that these medicines all build tolerance. And for whatever reason, as I say in the book, tolerance is controversial in the community of prescribers. It's not controversial for anyone who takes medicine for ADD, is it, ladies? Neither of you would question it. And I don't know why it's controversial. I cite a couple of really good articles in there. And the reason that is stated is because no one has done research to prove it. Now, would anyone like to guess why that research hasn't been done? Who funds drug research?
Okay, there you go.
Which pharmaceutical company wants to pay for research to prove that you should take less of their medicine?
Mm-hmm. I have my own personal research.
Yeah, really.
And I say that in the book. I say you don't need to believe anything I say about this in the book. You and your physician can do an experiment to prove it and do what I think both of these young women do, and that is take regular breaks 4 times a year for a week or 14 days. Talk with your prescriber about that. That keeps people from getting on these maxi doses of medication that we see.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to some phone calls here. Let's go to let's go to Wayne from Kansas City, Missouri. Wayne, you're on Up to Date.
Hi. I'm 57 years old. I was diagnosed with adult ADHD back in 1997, and I was prescribed a dexedrine, and that really helped me a lot, and I took it for several years, and then I developed heart disease, and I had open heart surgery, and so now they won't prescribe it anymore because of my heart condition. And I was just wondering if there were any new drugs out there that someone with my condition could take, or if they're doing any research about new medicines that can help people who can't take the normal drugs that are prescribed.
It's a great question. They're always researching this because it's a $1 billion industry, and unfortunately, dexedrine is in the same. It's I think one component of Adderall, I believe. I would have to go back and check that. But all the drugs that are really effective for ADHD are stimulant based, and therefore do pose some risk for people with heart conditions. The two that came out recently, or in the last 10 years, that were supposed to be non-stimulant alternatives, I talk about them in the book, and they have just not proven to be very effective because they're not hitting the dopamine receptors we talked about earlier.
Yeah. Wayne, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good luck.
I think it also is important to remember we've gotten into a really interesting medicine conversation, and it's important. But the other mistake people make is they go in and get their kid on medicine, or they get themselves on medicine, and then they don't get the therapy component. And all of the major organizations, and the two young women in our office are on our show today, are going to agree that the correct treatment is a combination of medicine and a therapy process. They do share their feelings, but not where you lay on the couch. It's where you're really learning strategies that I teach in this book to get everyday living done. If you don't do that, then it's kind of like medicine's like putting gas in your car, and then you drive around and around and around in the parking lot, kind of like the cover of my book, and don't go anywhere.
Jordan, what kind of therapy did you get? Or maybe you're still getting.
Yeah, I'm actually still getting it. I didn't get it for a long time, and when I did get it is actually when I started getting on the right medications and, the right dosages and all of that.
Yeah.
What I did personally, what worked best for me, was I first found a psychologist and spoke with them, and then got recommended to a psychiatrist from them. And they worked together and communicated together regarding me, as well as I also went and did testing with my psychiatrist, which was super helpful. And the thing that I found interesting, too, with past psychiatrists, not my current one, is that they have you come in for like a 15-minute appointment. The first appointment oftentimes is 30 minutes. And I feel like they oftentimes don't get, to really know
the richness of your situation.
Exactly. Yeah. They don't really get all the questions answered and all of that. And so having that psychologist, especially if they do communicate, really helps. That way, if your psychologist notices changes in you, or if they notice your tolerance, is being affected by the medication, they can tell you and your psychiatrist, hey, this is what we need to do with the dosage, or hey, we need to add this or take this away. Because, a parent's there, and a parent's there to notice, but a parent can only notice and understand so much in the medication realm. So it's definitely really helpful to have the both, and it's been great for me personally.
Sarah, how about you? What kind of therapy did you undergo?
Well, I actually started off because I wasn't really sure how to go about getting a diagnosis or seeing anyone about getting help. So I started off by seeing a doctor, just a regular physician, And I told her what my problem was, and she said she didn't really understand the whole diagnosis as well as she should, so she wanted me to see a psychologist. So she actually recommended someone for me. And I went in for testing, and the first day we just kind of talked. And I think he was kind of skeptical at first about whether I would have ADD or not. And, well, I got through all of high school without being diagnosed, and mostly it was because I had really bad anxiety about feeling stupid and forgetting things all the time. So I covered it up. Like, I knew I'd forget things all the time, so I had post-it notes everywhere. Mm-hmm. I had post-it notes covering my desk. And kind of the second I mentioned that to my psychologist was when he was like, okay, that's kind of a telltale. So we kind of went from there. We talked about, like, different things that might make, like, kind of just talked about my story, basically, so he could pick up different things about me that would show that I have ADD. And then from there, we did different tests where I took a test, and then two people who know me very well, like my brother and my mother is who I chose, mm-hmm. Took a test on me too. And he said because I had anxiety, my mom and my brother may not show as strong of tests for having ADD as like my test would show because they didn't see it in me as much as I felt it.
Mm-hmm. And that's because I should throw in, because I know exactly what you're talking about. That means that sometimes anxiety is almost like its own stimulant.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have both, it will help you get through life better than the straight ADD people with no anxiety.
Right. My anxiety just kind of covered up my ADD because I understood what I thought was wrong with me, and I did what I could to fix it. So that's what covered it up for so long. And basically we went through those testings, and sure enough, my mom and my brother didn't show as strong of results for having ADD as I did. But after talking with my therapist and everything like that for multiple sessions, we kind of came to the diagnosis that I did have it because we had that relationship where he could see, like, throughout my life, different scenarios, how I reacted, and that it was in an ADD kind of way.
Yeah.
And I continue to see him every 2 weeks-ish now, except for when I leave for breaks and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's really important to see someone continuously because even though you're on medicine, there's still ways that you react to things that's different than everyone else. Like, even though I'm on medicine that helps me focus, I still will handle situations differently, understand things differently. And I can talk that out with him. So he helps me get an understanding of what's going on in my brain when I'm doing things. And then when I'm not on my medicine, when I take my med breaks and stuff, I can also use that knowledge of how my brain works to work through having ADD without being medicated.
That's interesting.
So I can still function right.
So don't just take the medicine. You have to do a little bit more work besides
you need
that.
A little more talking.
Back to some phone calls. Our topic again today, ADD, ADHD. Danny from Kansas City North. Welcome, Danny.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I had a couple questions. I was diagnosed with learning disabilities and ADD as a child, and I think it was like third grade. I've never had any type of treatment for the ADD. I really want to get on some type of medicine or something. I don't know about how to do that. And then also I was wondering, is it common for children with learning disabilities to have ADD as well?
So let me start with your second question first, and that is, yes, it is, but the trick in the testing in that situation is to parse out what is the ADD and what is the learning disability. For example, the term dyslexia really just means any disorder of reading. Well, guess what? People with ADD, many of them do not like to read, or they cannot retain the knowledge they read, and both young women are nodding.
That's a big one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy to think they have dyslexia or they have another sort of learning disability. So to some degree, you want to try to rule out the ADD before you chase another LD. Sarah just gave a strikingly good example of how to not only go about getting the diagnosis. You'll notice in her story that the psychologist was skeptical. And I say in the book, people may think we're being kind of wily in a good intake interview, like we don't believe you. And it isn't that we don't believe you. It's that we want to be sure you're not incorrectly diagnosed. And she describes going through several sessions of this, really collecting the story. I like how you mm-hmm. describe that. So that then the therapist finally does begin to see, okay, this person's not your typical presentation. So for you on the phone, you want to look around the metro for somebody who does this a lot, who knows ADD well, who uses testing. It doesn't have to be a psychologist, but it needs to be somebody who does some testing using one of those standardized instruments and can spend the time with you for two or three or five or whatever it takes sessions to really find out if this does fit you or not before you head in for the meds.
I hope that helps, Danny.
It does. Thank you so much.
Good luck. Yeah, you bet. Let's go to Mark from Overland Park. Mark, you're on Up to Date with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. Good morning.
Hello. Hi, Dr. Wes. Hi, Steve. How are you guys doing?
Good, Mark.
Great.
How are you?
My youngest son and I were he was in high school. He was diagnosed with ADHD. We went to a psychiatrist and did a bunch of testing. And while we were in their meeting, and I was just sitting in with him, the psychiatrist looked at me and said, "Why don't we test you?"
I know where this is headed.
Horse, buddy. And so they tested me, and both of us got put on Vyvanse. And just like the young lady said, it was like we both laugh at each other because we'll go to lunch and we'll talk about, so this is what the other half lives like.
So
wow.
Beautifully
yeah.
put. I want to underline this call. I'm going to probably remember it for years to come. Everybody listening, there's this kind of bizarre trend now. The jackboot heel of the drug lords coming in and turning your child into a zombie. And listen to this fellow and his presumably son. They're chuckling, they're laughing, they're thanking their mm-hmm. stars mm-hmm. that they finally are liberated to be able to be the people they are. And they're happy. And that's what I see every day in my office, 5 days a week. I don't see any zombies. I don't see any jackboot heels. This is the goal we have, is exactly what they're talking about.
It's refreshing to get to finally express yourself the way
exactly.
you want.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Beautifully put.
I'm telling you, my job requires me to focus on schematic, and I would have to, before I was on Vyvanse, I would have to look at a schematic and take a break. Look at it,
yeah.
take a break. Look at it before I can get the picture of the whole thing. Now, if I could just focus like a laser,
wow.
It's kind of funny because it's like, wow, I've never been able to do this. But my important thing is, the one I wanted to stress is a lot of people will sit there and cry about how things could have been had they been on Vyvanse or whatever medication sooner in their life. And I kind of look at my ADD as kind of like a blessing because I have found out about a bunch of subjects that really interest me, and I know a lot about a bunch of subjects to talk intelligently to people instead of just being a wallflower at a party.
Yeah.
I don't know if you understand. In every one of the first 10 chapters in the book, I have a section called The Advantages of Whatever Principle I'm Talking About.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about the things that people with ADD do better than the rest of us, because it's good to notice that, even though, as you pointed out, it's liberating to be on medicine. It's also good to understand the creativity and spontaneity that people with ADD bring to our lives. The other thing I'll mention is this call illustrates the heritability of ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
How often we get a child, teenager, younger child come in, we get them diagnosed, they improve dramatically, and the parent comes in and is like, can I talk to you after the session?
Mm-hmm.
And they say, I just am beginning to realize this is like me at that age, and I think I have it. And we test them and take a hard look at that and often find just what the caller's saying.
Yeah. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. Let's go back to David from Independence. I think I dropped him by mistake. David, good morning. Nice to have you.
Well, thanks for taking my call again. My situation is I'm very dyslexic. I'm very ADD. I've, after 30-plus years, I finally found a medication that works for me. The problem my son now has is, because of his IQ, the school system does not want to put him in a situation that benefits him because their parameters are you have to have an IQ below a certain point. He's doing much better with the medication, but he still needs tutors and study buddies.
Yeah,
that are essential to being able to focus and learn and so forth. And it's just such a shame that you've got to hoe it yourself. When a tutor would just be so much better.
That is one of those questions that's pregnant with so many possibilities. It's probably one I'm going to write down for a future show where we will talk about school accommodations for people with special needs across the board, because I have a couple of people to draw on from the community I think would be helpful in that regard. The short version is that getting an IEP, Individualized Education Plan, right now is like pulling teeth out of a tiger. And there have been changes in the law and financing that make it much harder to get. So you do have the option of what's called a 504, which is a less legally binding accommodation for kids. And then below that is the totally non-legally binding student improvement plan. And I think I would try to go through that route rather than a formal IEP.
Okay. I'll get one more caller here before we leave this hour. Linda from Kansas City, Missouri. Linda, go quickly if you would.
Okay. Well, I have a question.
Yes.
That my daughter was diagnosed when she was small with ADD, and she's in her 30s now, and she decided sometime in her 20s that she didn't have it anymore, and she's driving us all crazy. Is there one way that I can bring it to her attention that she does have that? She can't even hold one conversation. She talks to three of us at the same time, and then she can't figure out why she doesn't remember anything.
We're just laughing because the young women and I did a lot of prep for this show, and you're describing them both. But anyway, by all means, the correct solution to your problem is clearly to get on Amazon right now and to order 20 copies of my book and to lay them all around the house. So wherever your daughter turns, she can't miss it. In seriousness, the book is written specifically for 15 to 30-year-olds who are in this situation, and it works well for other adults and as well as for parents with younger kids. But I think the book will help her recognize herself, and it makes a compelling argument to go ahead and pursue treatment.
Well, Linda, thank you for the call. I appreciate
that.
It. All the best to you.
Repeat your book information, though, too.
I'll put it out right here. Dr. Wes Crenshaw, he's the author of the new book, I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not, Successful Living with ADD and ADHD. Wes, always good to have you here.
Great to see you next month.
Sarah and Jordan, thank you so much for your great contributions this hour. I really appreciate you coming in today. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, our political pundits weigh in. They'll be here to talk about all the latest issues in Missouri and Kansas and what's going on with President Obama. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, Cody Newell, and Jenny Witte. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.